Good day, everyone, and welcome to the 12th presentation by Drinker Biddle of Inside the Beltway conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Reich. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, Christy, thank you very much. And hello, everybody. We've got a great program today and a lot of material. By now, I assume that all of you all have heard at least a little bit, maybe quite a bit, about the details of the fiduciary proposal that the Department of Labor released back in April. We're going to talk about what it means, though. Well, obviously, we have to discuss the rules a little bit, but we're not going to drag you through all the rules again. We're going to talk to you about how it's going to impact advisors. That's the focus of today's call, and I think you'll find it very valuable. The other speakers on the phone with me are Brad Campbell from our Washington, D.C. office. Brad was the Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration in the George W. Bush administration. As a result, we've got somebody on the phone with us who has a lot of inside knowledge about how the regulatory process works. Also is Jim Dolan from NetPixis, who is a vice president in their retirement strategies group. Before I get to them, though, let me just go through a couple of quick housekeeping details. We're recording this session, as we do all of our sessions. So it will be recorded if you want to listen to it again, or if you want to refer it to other people in your firm or outside your firm, feel free to do so. This is a service to you all. It'll take a few days to get it recorded and posted. When it is, it'll be posted at www.drinkerbiddle, the firm name, drinkerbiddle.com. And there's a tab there called Resources. It'll be there. Having said that, you can probably forget everything I just said because as soon as we post it, we'll be sending an email out to all of the registrants. So if you register for this, you'll also get an email that has the link into it and that tells you that it has been posted. So one way or another, you're going to be able to find it and listen to it or refer it to other people if you want. Having said that, let me turn it over to Jim Dolan to speak a little bit about NetPixis and their participation in the webcast and the wonderful support that they give to Brad and me and putting on these programs. Jim?
Fred, thanks so much. And Brad, thanks for making the time to be on the call today. And I'd want to thank everyone for taking time out of their day to join us on these calls. We do these calls quarterly, and we're excited about the partnership and the ability to bring this great information to the marketplace. As Fred said, my name is Jim Dolan. I work with NetPixis Global Asset Management. We are a multi-affiliate organization which provides the access to 20 institutional money managers across the globe. Some of the firms you might be familiar with are Luma Sales, Harris Associates, and the Oakmark Funds, as well as Gateway. Our goal at NetPixis is to provide the ability for our investors to lead better financial lives, and we do this through a process called durable portfolio construction. I'd invite you to take a look at our website at netixis.com to learn more about our focus on retirement as well as our retirement spending accounts. This is a new and contemporary approach to helping investors meet their income needs during retirement. So again, thank you for taking the time to be on the call today. And with Brad, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim, and thanks, Fred, and most importantly, thanks to all of you for, again, taking time out of your schedule to listen to us talk about these things. We're just humbled by the response that we keep getting to these, so we really appreciate it. As Fred said, we're not trying to make this just another webcast where we run through what the proposal is. You've probably already done a bunch of those. You've read everything that people have been sending out. That said, we do have to at least to make sure we're all on the same page for the discussion that's going to follow about some of the issues that we think this presents and how it's going to affect different types of advisors. We do need to, of course, run through the basics so we're all on the same page. So, what the DOL proposed, they proposed it on April 20th. We're looking at July 20th, although there is some debate as to whether it's July 20th or July 21st for the new end of the comment period. And so everyone's in the middle of writing their comments, having evaluated the rule. And basically, what the rule does is it dramatically expands the definition of fiduciary investment advice for ERISA purposes. And by dramatically expanding it, it does it not just in terms of what constitutes advice. You know, what is it that, what the things that you say, there are more of those that are now fiduciary advice than they were before. But it also expands it in terms of the implications and the effects on what types of products it applies to. So the, you know, the overall effect here is that DOL would become, in essence, the primary regulator of certainly compensation arrangements, but also to a significant extent the conduct of advisors, not just to ERISA plans, but also to rollovers or other distribution arrangements and to IRAs. So again, just to emphasize, to make sure we're all clear, if you are advising an individual who owns an IRA, it's not connected with a rollover, it's not connected with a plan, DOL would be determining at least your compensation arrangements or affecting those compensation arrangements with respect to that advice to an IRA owner. And so the easiest way to think of it is DOL has taken the old rule from 1975, which I shouldn't call it the old rule, it's the current rule, the rule that's in place because, of course, we're at the beginning of a regulatory process to make change, and we're looking at least a year before that would be completed. But the current rule says that you're providing investment advice under ERISA. Under ERISA's definition, when you need a five-part test, that you're regularly providing advice for a fee subject to a mutual understanding, by the way, individualized advice for a fee, subject to a mutual understanding that this advice will be a primary basis for their decision-making. And what DOL is changing, there are several kind of important concepts. They're eliminating the regular requirement, so one-time advice can be fiduciary. They're eliminating the requirement of clear mutuality, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means. In other words, there doesn't have to be this mutual understanding that this is fiduciary advice you're receiving, the way DOL would recast it. I think of it this way. There's really three boxes or three columns, and you have to do one thing in each column to be considered in providing fiduciary advice under this arrangement. So the first column is, who are you talking to? And if you're talking to a plan fiduciary, if you're talking to plan participants or beneficiaries, if you're talking to IRA owners, these are the people that you would be talking to that could give rise to fiduciary advice. The second column is, what are you talking to them about? And this is where some of the most significant changes are occurring. Obviously, recommendations regarding, you know, buy, sell, hold recommendations, that's clearly fiduciary advice that's similar to the current rule. But one of the big ones is a recommendation to take a distribution or do a rollover from a plan or an IRA would itself be fiduciary advice. And this is a significant change. It's a reversal of DOL's previous determination. And it really is one of the big issues that's going to impact, and we'll discuss this in more detail later, going to impact advisors, because it raises two questions. One, how do I go about making a prudent recommendation that this rollover is, in fact, you know, a prudent choice for this participant, meaning I'm going to have to take into account the current plan they're in, its expenses, its available investments, its available services, and then reach a conclusion that the IRA would be prudent, even though it's more expensive in many cases, because of the additional services, the individualized advice, because of the additional investments available, et cetera. That's one part of it. The second part is you would also have to address any prohibited transactions that would now apply to a rollover recommendation, where those were a much smaller concern previously. The third thing that you can be giving advice about that would become fiduciary advice is if you recommend an asset manager or a financial advisor. In other words, the recommendation of an advisor is itself a fiduciary act if it meets the requirements of this regulation. And that raises a lot of questions about, are you being paid in connection with providing that recommendation? And we might discuss some of those here in a little bit. The last component deals with certain valuations. This does not include ESOP valuations. DOL excluded that from this regulation. But it does raise questions about other types of valuations, and that's an area where we'll no doubt be seeing a lot of comments. So that's the second category. That's what you're talking to them about. The third column, as I think of it, is really how does this relationship arise? And so either you're acknowledging fiduciary status, in which case you're a fiduciary, or, and this is some of the big language that eliminates the mutuality and the regularity and the other things I mentioned, you have either a written or a verbal agreement, arrangement, or understanding that the advice will be individualized or specifically directed to the recipient of the advice. So there's some big changes in these this language here. Note the elimination of mutuality, as I mentioned before, but also individualized advice is not the standard. It includes advice directed to the recipient, and that's going to be an area where there's a lot of comment as well as to what exactly directed to means. You know, what is an oral understanding that advice is being directed to someone? This is an area that we've not seen before that raises a lot of questions about inadvertent fiduciary status and other issues. Now, DOL also provided certain carve-outs of things that are not advice, and one of those is a large plan carve-out. So if the plan fiduciary, and this only applies to the plan fiduciary, if you're talking to a plan fiduciary with a plan that has more than 100 participants or more than $100 million in assets, then you can give them advice that's not fiduciary. In other words, it's kind of a limited seller's exemption for large plans. If it's a plan with 100 participants or more, but less than $100 million in assets, there has to be a written acknowledgement by the plan fiduciary. If it's more than $100 million, you just have to assure yourself that it's more than $100 million. This is proving somewhat controversial in that this would, in effect, require that all small plans can only use fiduciary advisors, but plans with more than 100 participants would have the option of using non-fiduciary advisors, the option of being sold something. And there are questions about, is that the right division? Is it appropriate to have small and large plans treated differently? Are those the right numbers? All of those questions coming up. The other big exception or carve-out. Let me be precise in my language because we're going to be talking about exemptions in a separate thing. The other carve-out, in other words, advice that is not fiduciary in nature, is education. So it retains this current exclusion DOL has on educational information that's not advice. And the current discussion of that occurs in Interpretive Bulletin 96-1, which many of you are probably familiar with. This is the current guidance that says you can give a participant a model asset allocation that's individualized to their needs, but you can't pick the individual investments to populate that model. You can, however, tell them what investments in their plan correspond to the asset classes that this model represents. DOL is proposing to restrict that significantly by no longer allowing those educational materials to reference specific investments available under the plan. And that's an area that's proving very controversial with advisors and plans concerned and other providers concerned about what this would mean for enrollment meetings, what it would mean for model portfolios, what it would mean for other scenarios where you're talking to participants, and how useful is education if it can't reference the particular investments of the plan. So there's a concern there. This education exclusion, this education carve-out, also allows you to have broader discussions with participants and IRA owners, as well as plans. So it is expanded in that way to include plans and IRA owners, and it also allows more discussion about retirement income or distribution, kind of withdrawal sort of strategies. How do you manage your assets in retirement? Those issues are allowed to be discussed in greater detail. So that's kind of the broad overview of the change. There are also a couple of significant exemptions to
Brad, could I jump in just with couple of comments on the, or additions rather, on the fiduciary definition? As Brad mentioned, the referral of a discretionary investment manager, of a fiduciary discretionary investment manager, which would be almost any investment manager with discretion, or any investment manager with discretion would be a fiduciary. So the referral or recommendation of a discretionary investment manager would in and of itself be a fiduciary act, and it would cause the advisor to become a fiduciary if the fee is received in return. The most obvious place where that comes up, for example, in an IRA, would be that discretionary investment managers are very commonly used in IRAs, and they often pay a solicitor's fee to the advisor. That would now be covered by the definition of fiduciary, and if the fee paid to the advisor wasn't level, in other words, if this investment manager paid a 25 basis point fee and another one paid a 50 basis point solicitor's fee, you could have just a classic prohibited transaction problem. So I think that's a pretty significant issue. Having said that, though, That's actually a longstanding position that the Department of Labor has had for many years. The DOL says they've had that position since 1984, but this would actually get it written into a rule. Also, a new position that wasn't there before was a referral to a non-discretionary investment advisor who would be a fiduciary by virtue of giving advice. It's also a fiduciary act, and it would cause the person making the referral to become a fiduciary, subject to those same kinds of private transaction issues, if the person making the referral received a fee. I'm not familiar enough with industry practices, but I don't know that referrals of non-discretionary, I don't know whether referrals of non-discretionary investment advisors typically result in solicitor's fees or other fees. But keep those in mind because they're a little bit below the radar screen in terms of what a lot of people are talking about. But I think they're material issues in IRAs, certainly for discretionary investment managers. As Brad mentioned also, almost any mention of a particular recommendation, of a particular investment rather, that's directed to somebody would be defined as fiduciary advice. And if you all think that through, that means that virtually every common sales practice to an IRA or a participant or a plan would become fiduciary investment advice subject to the prohibited transaction rules that Brad's going to get to in a second, as soon as I let him. We're talking about virtually every sales practice where investments are being sold to plans, participants, and IRAs. And just to add one footnote to what Brad said about education, as you all know, it's very common for plans to have asset allocation models. And within those models, when they're presented to participants, let's say 20% allocated to large cap blend, for there actually to be a name of one of the mutual funds in the plan listed in that category, that is of that category. And then the participant can either just check a box on the enrollment form or they can click a button on the website and be placed in that fund. That is how investment education is commonly being used today. This proposal would convert that presentation of the asset allocation model or the asset allocation percentages with funds listed next to each of them. That would convert that from investment education into investment advice, in other words, into a fiduciary act. And as Rad also pointed out, that's highly controversial, and many, many, many people who are preparing comment letters, some of whom we're helping, are going to be commenting negatively on that, pointing out that there haven't been any reported problems with it, and in fact that it has actually worked to help lots of participants. So that one's up in the air a little bit, but it is a significant issue within the proposal package. Brad, I just wanted to add that. Back to you.
No, those are great points, and let me go back to the fee issue for the referrals. Fred's referring to a situation where there's a clear upfront fee. One of the big questions, I think, is what about cases where I'm a service provider who's already providing a service to the plan, I'm getting a fee for that, and the plan asks me, hey, do you know some good advisors? And I say, yeah, here's three people that we've dealt with who seem to be good at what they're doing. Is the fee you're receiving for other services imputed over to that advice such that you are receiving a fee for it? I think we need a lot of clarification on how these fees interact with these new potential advice channels, because there's a lot of potential for inadvertent fiduciary status there. So moving on. So you've got a situation now where you have a lot more activity that can be advice, soliciting rollovers, as Fred was saying, making referrals, et cetera. And where you have potentials for differential compensation, meaning where you might get paid more if the participant does X than if the participant does Y, that can result in a prohibited transaction because you, as a fiduciary advisor, are influencing your own compensation or have an ability to do so by virtue of getting different amounts of payment for different investments. So DOL, recognizing that, said, okay, well, we're going to propose a couple of exemptions or amend some existing ones and propose a new exemption to try and let some of that traditional behavior occur. And the primary one that they developed that's new is the best interest contract exemption, or BICE, BICE for short. You might hear it called the BIC exemption or the BICE exemption. I think everyone's still trying to decide what acronym they prefer over the other. But what this says is, okay, if you're in this situation, we're going to give you some relief from these prohibited transactions if you sign a contract with the participant or the IRA owner. This is not available for advice to plans. That says you're going to adhere to what is essentially an ERISA fiduciary standard. It's slightly rewritten, but it's essentially the prudent man standard from ERISA. And you're going to have to make a bunch of warranties and representations and disclosures associated with the advice you give under this BICE agreement. And, for example, you have to provide disclosures, a 1, 5, and 10-year prospective estimate of all the costs for the participant to make that investment and the assumptions you use to rely on that. Retroactively, you'd have to provide on an annual basis how much the participant paid as a specific dollar amount to be in that particular investment for the last 12 months, including kind of everyone's fees and expenses all the way up and down the chain. A lot of disclosure issues and concerns about the ability of how that information could be collected, because what DOL is asking for is not something that currently is, we think, collected by any service providers, at least not in that type of format. And the warranties and representations have to include things like identifying all material conflicts and mitigating those. And it defines a material conflict as essentially anything that would influence the advisor's recommendation to the participant. There's a section in there specifically on advisor compensation, which is particularly confusing. It says that the financial institution with whom the advisor is affiliated, so think, say, the broker-dealer, for example, it doesn't have to be just that, but think of it that way for the moment, and the advisor, they have to have ensured that none of the compensation arrangements to the advisor would influence the advisor's judgment. Then it goes on to say, notwithstanding that, you can receive unlevel compensation or variable compensation, but only to the extent it doesn't influence your best judgment. And if it sounds circular, it's because that is circular. So there is a couple of areas that DOL identified as reasonable grounds for having variable compensation, what they call neutral factors. One example they gave was time. You know, if it takes an advisor more time to recommend one investment over another, to evaluate, say, some sort of annuity-based product versus an index fund, something of that nature, then that could be a basis for charging a different amount. But the problem with all of those is that this is also something where you're agreeing to subject yourself not to ERISA remedies, but to state law remedies for breach of contract. And there are also some questions about whether the warranties you have to make in this, whether breaching those can actually be a tort in some states. And that's all legal language that boils down to there's a significant expansion in who can sue you and where they can sue you. So you're no longer being sued in federal court under ERISA, but you can be sued in state court in a class action arrangement for breaching the terms of this contract. That's a big area of controversy in this BICE agreement. And then there's also the question of exactly how much relief does it provide? How much does it enable the advisor to do some of these arrangements? So one quick example would be a rollover. You know, I mentioned before that it's common for a rollover, an IRA receiving a rollover, to charge higher fees than the plan from which the rollover is coming, in large measure because an IRA is simply a different product. It's an individualized service to that particular participant that has different investments and opportunities as compared to an institutional-based accumulation vehicle, typically without individual advice, which is what most 401ks look like. So there's an inherent cost differential for the advisor who's involved in that. And it's not clear to me, frankly, and Fred, you can weigh on this as well, but I've read BICE many, many times, and it's not clear to me exactly how an advisor is getting relief using a BICE agreement for those rollovers. But that's what DOL said the intent of this was, to permit some of these activities by providing relief from some of the prohibited transactions subject to those large number of conditions I just laid out. Fred, any thoughts on that?
No, I think the big picture that it's going to be almost impossible for people to comply with BICE the way it's written, and I think that it will be rewritten. I mean, some of the things, that there's a website requirement that certain information be posted on a website. Even the way that's written, it would be almost impossible to do. Plus, if you then take it down to a very small RIA firm of just a couple of people, what's requested would be capital intensive and probably too expensive for a small firm. Similarly, there are certain financial disclosures that the large firms are telling me, large broker-dealers, for example, are telling me that would be extraordinarily expensive and take years to develop just because there isn't anything like that required anywhere else. For example, the annual report on the total amount earned by the broker-dealer in the preceding year, the annual report on the total expenses of all investments for the retirement investor in the preceding year, and so on. So that's an area that even if the large guys could figure a way to do it, given years to do it and millions of dollars, I don't know how a small advisory firm would be able to live with it. And then similarly, that neutral factors issue of the individual advisor, say for a broker-dealer, not being able to have comp that varies very much, if at all, is just not the way that the broker-dealer community has worked for years. It's not a commissioned model. It is a fee model that would be imposed on an industry that hasn't been structured to operate in that environment. So I just see on a practical level those problems being insurmountable, impossible for smaller firms because of the capital expense of and impossible for many larger firms because they simply aren't, they've operated for decades or 100 years or more in one model, and now they're being told they have to operate in a different model. So I guess, Brad, as my comments suggest, I think that is going to have to change, and they're going to be similar. I think it'll be disclosure-based primarily, but there's got to be some break in the DOL's position on these issues. One last thought. I don't know if you're going to get to it next, but there's also that exemption that we mentioned earlier, 84-24, for insurance products, which does cover sales to plans, which BIFE does not. And it also covers sales, 84-24 for insurance products also covers sales to IRAs, but it doesn't. But they moved mutual funds and individual variable annuities out of 84-24 and put them over under BIFE. So everything that Brad said would apply to them as well. Did I jump the gun on you, Brad?
No, that's great. I'm glad you did, because I think that's one of the big areas that I think we're also going to see a lot of comments on is, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense when you take products that are all designed around providing guaranteed income, like individual variable annuities and you know, all the other products there, and you start dividing them into two separate regulatory regimes. So, you know, if you're trying to give advice and you're looking at several different options for income, you're going to have one series of rules that are governing how you have to be paid and how you go about providing advice for the individual variable annuity, but another set of rules and another set of, you know, how you get paid that governs advice on, you know, sort of traditional insurance products. And it really doesn't make a lot of sense to have divided it up that way, and it's going to certainly increase compliance issues. I would echo also your comment that BICE as proposed just doesn't work. I mean, for one thing, you're proposing 8 months of transition period to construct entire new disclosure regimes. If nothing else, that simply can't be done in that amount of time at anything, even probably can't be done at all, much less done at any sort of reasonable cost. And remember, of course, ultimately all these costs are going to be borne by the participants and the IRA owners who are the end consumers of these products. So it's not an idle concern. DOL should be very focused on the cost issues here, because it's not as though, you know, this is just a slam on corporate America. It's in fact, of course, all these are passed through to the end participant who ostensibly the regulations intended to assist. So with that, maybe we should kind of dispense with the overview, Fred, and jump back into some of the details and looking at how this will affect particular folks.
Yeah. Let me start off by talking about how it's going to affect independent RIAs, and because that's pretty much the easiest to talk about and most straightforward compensation model. And by independent, by the way, I mean level fee, either a percent of assets or a dollar amount, and I mean no affiliated investment products. So there's no There's no money being earned other than the level fee, and nothing else being received from any source that has monetary value. So looking at, there are four things or four ways that our independent RIAs can give fiduciary advice. And let's talk about how it impacts them. What about advice to plans? Number one is plans. Well, it's going to be the same. If you have a pure level fee fiduciary advisor, you're already a fiduciary, so and you're a fiduciary under ERISA, so that will stay the same. Your duties will remain exactly the same. And because you're level fee, there's no prohibited transaction, and therefore there's no exemption. So your situation on advice to plans would be the same under the new rule if it comes through as written as it is today. Well, what about fiduciary advice to participants? Again, if you're going to be a fiduciary under the prudent man rule and reasonable expenses and duty of loyalty, all those traditional ERISA standards of care, to participants the same as to plans, and so the fiduciary part doesn't change. What about prohibited transactions? Well, from a prohibited transaction perspective, if you're providing level fee advice to participants, there is no prohibited transaction, so you don't have to worry about BICE and you don't have to worry about 8424. Well, what about advice to IRAs? Well, you know, this is one of the anomalies of the law. If you're a pure level fee independent RIA fiduciary advisor, you're not required to have a contract, because that's over under the prohibited transaction exemption. As a pure level fee advisor, there is no prohibited transaction, even to an IRA, and therefore you don't need to have you don't need a prohibited transaction exemption. You don't need BICE. You don't need a contract. Now, you do have your contract for fiduciary advice, but my point being that it doesn't change and you don't have to satisfy all the conditions. Curiously, this is the one place where the party would not be a fiduciary under the ERISA definition, because you don't have to get under BICE or 8424 unless you're selling an insurance product. But generally speaking, you don't have to claim relief from BICE or 8424 for level fee fiduciary advice to IRAs. You're subject to the fiduciary laws under the federal securities laws and under state securities laws, but not under ERISA. It's the one situation that's sort of off there by itself. Then finally, the one where this begins to get a little more complicated, what about rollovers? Well, as those of you who are fiduciaries to plans already know, back in 2005, the Department of Labor issued an advisory opinion that in so many words said if you're already a fiduciary to a plan, for example, a fiduciary advisor, and you make recommendations or even answer questions about distributions and rollovers, and you recommend an alternative that causes yourself to receive more money, it may be a prohibited transaction. In other words, it was worded in a funny way. It didn't finally resolve the issue, but it caught everybody's eyes and raised a lot of concerns. As a result of that, a lot of RIAs back in, after 2005, decided that they wouldn't provide recommendations for distributions anymore. They would only provide education, because education is not a recommendation. And, by the way, that continues to be the case under the proposal. So those advisors are pretty well situated for dealing with a proposal if they've already switched over to the education model. Let me point out, though, that things have happened since 2005. For example, there was a FINRA regulatory notice that did an interesting job of laying out what kind of education is required. And even though FINRA and the DOL are two separate entities, I've looked at that FINRA regulatory notice, and it makes sense. I believe the DOL's thinking would be remarkably similar. So my point being that education isn't just sitting down and having a little conversation. Education is well-defined. You have to talk about this, 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 and that. And if you're going the education route, make sure that you're talking about the right things and that you can document it. Because from a legal perspective, this isn't just about doing the right thing. It's also about proving that you did the right thing. My point being, just to wrap this up in a nutshell, that under the new rule, it's now clear that if you're even if you're not a fiduciary to the plan, anybody who makes a recommendation to a participant to take a rollover and then invests the rollover is now a fiduciary. And if you're making more money in the IRA than you were in the plan, that could be a privative transaction. Your way of getting out of the privative transaction in most cases would be BICE. But as we've already told you, BICE is expensive, it's difficult, it's complicated, and it may be impossible. I would not recommend anybody at this point that they count on being able to comply with BICE. Instead, I would recommend that if they want to do their planning now before we see the final, that they go the education alternative. And frankly, my suspicion is that even once we see the final, my advice would be to go the education alternative. Brad, that's it for RIAs. You want to add something or move on to...
Yeah, let me be a little bit more of a downer, because while I certainly agree that for most of the structure of an independent RIA where you have level fee, most of that's not going to change because you're already operating as an ERISA fiduciary. There is no prohibited transaction. But I think the IRA and education pieces are big changes that will affect you. As Fred said, I think if you're looking to do actual rollover advice, I think there are some folks who have tried to not be near rollovers already, but there's a lot of others who have instead developed a robust process of disclosure and other elements that they felt was enough to let them go ahead and do rollovers despite the 2005 opinions suggesting that it may be, not is, but may be a prohibited transaction. Those are folks who are now going to have to be looking at BICE or 8424 or something to enable that. And as we've discussed, BICE probably doesn't work, but assuming DOL fixes it so that it does work in a final rule, that's going to be a piece that definitely grabs you if you want to be in the rollover business. And it's worth pointing out to everybody that the rollover business is growing exponentially faster than the ERISA business because the ERISA money is rolling out of ERISA plans into IRAs. So that's going to be a tough business to just turn your back on. You're probably going to have to really think about compliance issues and be interested in that. Secondly, on the education piece, while I certainly agree with Fred that education is a way to avoid getting into some of the fiduciary issues related to rollovers, my suspicion is a lot of independent RIAs are providing education to participants in plans they serve rather than providing individualized fiduciary participant advice, probably because of business issues and so forth. I mean, it's tough to find a business model in many cases for a lot of independent RIAs that make that individualized fiduciary advice a service that they can provide. So you're probably using model portfolios and other common educational strategies in plans you serve now. You need to be aware, again, that you can no longer reference, if this were to go through as DOL proposes, you could no longer reference individual investments available in the plan, which is going to significantly impact your ability to offer the education services. So I think that's two ways that independent RIAs get hit.
Brad, I think independent RIAs could actually include the investments and the models because they don't make any extra money that way.
So you're saying that they would become fiduciary, but despite the fact it's fiduciary, it doesn't present a problem. That's certainly true as well. That's a good point. I think that would be the difference, though, is that it's no longer non-fiduciary service. It would now be an additional fiduciary service, even going the education to participant route.
Yeah, and they'd have to include it in their 408B2 disclosures. They should include it in their advisory agreements. I mean, there's a whole host of issues that flow from it.
All right.
Brad, you want to do BICE or broker-dealers?
Okay. Yeah, so let's talk about issues facing broker-dealers. And I think particularly, again, let's focus on looking at the IRA piece. Because while a lot of these same issues are going to apply if you're a broker-dealer who is currently advising on a non-fiduciary basis a plan, obviously these same issues would hit you there. But I think probably the biggest adjustment, the biggest difference for most folks is looking at the IRA marketplace. So again, if you're a broker-dealer who's advising someone who has an individual IRA, if you're currently being compensated on commissions and other ways where you're getting unlevel compensation, that's no longer going to be permissible. Again, even if it's not a rollover situation, even if it's just a standalone IRA. And so this raises a number of questions that BICE also potentially addresses. So, and there are limitations on how it addresses. So let's say, for example, that you give advice but only over a limited menu of available investments. So you have proprietary funds or otherwise have a limited menu of things that you actually provide advice about. DOL has said that the BICE agreement would allow you to continue to have a limited menu, but you would have to, the financial institution as well as each advisor in each scenario, would have to conclude that they can, despite these limitations, offer a prudent recommendation, that there are enough options available to be able to prudently advise a participant or an IRA owner about investments in that. And that, again, in each situation, an advisor, not only does that have to be made at the institutional level, sort of the financial institution, the broker-dealer level, but also each advisor who's talking to the participant or the IRA owner would have to determine that for this particular case, yes, it's still true, that this can be prudent despite the limitations. And there's a lot of questions coming out about, well, what exactly does that limitation on proprietary product mean? What is, you know, how do we reach that conclusion? And one of the issues this relates back to is traditionally this has been viewed as a selling activity, and DOL is converting it to a impartial fiduciary advice activity, which is not an easy or natural transition. So it leads to these kinds of conditions and reviews that have to take place. We mentioned already the referrals to discretionary investment managers. One thing that's important to note in addition to the referrals is that the BICE agreement is not available to a discretionary investment manager. So if you're going to be doing a rollover and being, say, the discretionary manager of those funds, the BICE agreement may or may not even be available to you because it doesn't apply to discretionary investment management. Similarly, the BICE agreement does not apply to every asset class. As proposed, DOL limited it to only certain types of assets for which the relief is available. On others, you could still give advice, but you wouldn't be able to do so through the BICE exemption. So you'd have to ensure that there wasn't a privated transaction. To give you an example, it's hard to define why DOL picked the division between asset classes it did. I'm just going to go with the technical terms of ordinary and fancy. Things that are sort of routine investments you see all the time in plans, mutual funds, money market funds, CDs, you know, whatever it might be, collective investment trusts, et cetera. Those are all things DOL said you can give advice about and still have the BICE agreement, but it excludes things like options and hedge funds and non-publicly traded REITs and a variety of other investments that you may well currently be advising IRA owners about, but DOL is not going to be providing relief under the BICE agreement for, which is going to raise some concerns, again, about how you do rollovers and how you deal with advice in those situations, given that there would be a pure level fee requirement for those types of assets with no particular relief available. Fred, any thoughts on that?
No, I think you did a great job. As you all can see, that's going to dramatically change the conduct of business, particularly from a broker-dealer perspective. And, you know, as Brad said, when you look at level fees, I mean, that is the broker-dealer getting level fees or is the financial advisor getting level fees? It's actually a bigger issue than that. I mean, because if the fees aren't level, and we're using level to mean that the recommendations or advice can't impact the amount of fees. That's what level really means. But you look at the whole entity, so you look at proprietary products. Even if the advisor is only getting 25 basis points, but there are proprietary products involved, then the overall entity is getting more money. And if you think about IRAs, you can see where that would be a pretty common practice. Now, what that means is you'd have to come under BICE. But then if you levelize the individual advisor's compensation and satisfied all those other difficult to impossible disclosure requirements, then the entity as a whole, the aggregated entities, could receive unlevel compensation. That's essentially what BICE does. But it puts the onus on the organization to have disclosures and on the individual advisor to more or less levelize their compensation. So it is definitely a brave new world if this goes through as is. Brad, did you want to add anything, or should we jump right over to distributions and rollovers and add a few notes on that?
Let's jump right along since we got a lot to get through.
Good. Well, we've already really introduced the subject with some of our previous comments, and a recommendation to take a distribution from a plan or an IRA. Keep that in mind. That's different. There's been nothing in the past anywhere about distributions from IRAs. So, for example, a recommendation to take a distribution from a plan or an IRA would be a fiduciary recommendation. Then if the person making the recommendation received more money in the new IRA or in the new plan or in a rollover IRA, that would be a prohibited transaction, and therefore you would need BICE with all of its impossibilities. The only exception to that under the proposal would be if you recommended a rollover to a traditional annuity or an indexed annuity. That would still be under 8424, which has a different set of disclosures, which are much easier to comply with, frankly. I think that's going to be doable by and large. But also, even there's the contract requirement. You have to have a contract signed before you make the recommendation. Keep that in mind. How hard is that going to be? And then you're subject to the best interest standard, and you're subject to disclosure of material conflicts. So there are a set of disclosures and a set of requirements even under 8424, but the financial disclosures are just so much easier. 8424 almost seems like relief rather than something that's tightened. But in fact, it is tightened. It is subject to higher standards under the proposal than it was. But I don't know if you all know this, but by the very fact that it's called 8424, that means it was initially issued in 1984. So it's been around for a while. A lot of my clients have complied with it for years. Even the toughened up version of it's going to be doable. So since you're a fiduciary by virtue of giving advice to take a distribution, you have to act in the best interest of the participant. So you would need, I think, to have go through a list of criteria and be in a position to show, in case you were ever challenged, that your advice for the participant, for example, to take the money out of the plan with all of its low-cost investments, assuming that's the case, and put them into an IRA with higher-cost investments and fees, assuming that's the case, you'd have to be in a position to show that's in the best interest of the participant. Is that possible? Of course it's possible. You're going to provide more services. Many of the advisors I work with provide financial planning in connection with their rollover services. That's something the individual isn't getting in the plan. You're going to provide a human being who can answer questions about distributions and how do I make my money last for my lifetime and how should I invest in retirement different than in the plan. There aren't humans. I mean, the whole plan world has been pushed to electronic communications because of the pricing pressures. So there's much less human contact in plans than there is where there's an advisor working with a participant on IRAs. So the services can be, even though the fees are probably higher, the services can be much more valuable and much more robust and much broader encompassing. In addition, most plans are highly inflexible in the ways that they can distribute money in retirement, or they may even charge for distributions other than, say, minimum required distributions. But in an IRA, you have complete flexibility in distributions. And so you can take out so much a month. A year from now, you can change that. Your granddaughter is going to get married, and you want to help with the cost of the wedding. You can take out extra money. Just a lot of flexibility in IRAs that don't exist in plans. Now, in due course, plans may come to offer that, but that's generally not the case today. So, yes, I think you can be competent and prudent fiduciary and making a recommendation, but I think you have to go through the analysis if this comes in. I just think that is the next step, that there's going to be a lot more thought given to what's the best thing to do when a person is eligible for a distribution.
Brad, if I could jump in there, Fred, I absolutely agree, and I think one of the things that people have to remember is we keep using this phrase best interest, which is the phrase that DOL has introduced into some of these, you know, the BICE agreement and other places. You need to understand best interest is not actually a standard. It's just a name they've applied to what is essentially the current ERISA fiduciary standard that they've rewritten into these agreements. So when you hear best interest, think ERISA fiduciary process, and that's all process. process and its documentation. You're going to have to be able to show that you considered all of these relevant factors and concluded then that the IRA was prudent for the participant, taking into account the differential costs as Fred just described. But also you have to remember, because this is an ERISA fiduciary situation, that's only half the analysis. You could give the best, most prudent advice, the best interest for your client. Yes, the rollover is the way to go, but it might still be a prohibited transaction for you to engage in it, despite the value of the advice. So that, you know, there are all these issues you have to consider there. The other quick thing I'd point in, and you know, Fred was emphasizing that this isn't just plan to IRA, but also IRA to IRA, IRA to plan, and plan to plan. Those of you who do enrollment meetings on this plan to plan issue, you need to consider that, because I think it's pretty common for people in enrollment situations to say, yeah, and by the way, you should roll your money over from your prior employer into the current 401k plan for your new employer. That is now no longer a throwaway line about preventing leakage and trying to make sure assets stay together. That's now fiduciary advice. Before you can say that, you're going to have to know the details of their prior plan and what it cost and what its investments were to then make a prudent recommendation that the participant ought to go to the new plan given its pricing and its investments. And that may not always be the case. And I don't know if DOL intended that, but that is one of the effects. And I think that's going to actually work counter to DOL's general interests in trying to reduce leakage and otherwise. But I just thought I'd point that out.
No, I think that's a great point. And that's why I think, you know, what I'm seeing, at least for the time being, is that more and more people are moving away from making recommendations about, you know, moving money from IRA to IRA, plan to plan, and all those different combinations that Brad mentioned, and they're going to the education alternative. It's not comfortable because folks want to make recommendations because advisors are really knowledgeable about these issues, and they can help participants, and participants want answers, not education. But for the moment, because education is the only sort of safe way to deal with this without getting into all the prohibited transaction issues that Brad mentioned. I would point out again, though, education is not just a conversation. There are certain specific things that need to be covered, and I think written material should be given to the participants saying, here are your options, and here are the considerations for each option, partially to complete the education, but also partially to prove that education was given rather than a recommendation. From a lawyer's perspective, things in writing are critically important because they're old and cold by the time the issue comes up, and old and cold is good because we all know memories tend to be pretty selective. Operator, Christy, why don't we, we'll just make one or two more comments and then we'll open it up to questions. Matter of fact, Brad, why don't you make the closing comment? Where do you think this is going to have the greatest impact? And then we'll go straight to questions after that.
I think the rollover provisions in general simply don't work the way DOL has proposed this, and I think that's a big problem because, as you pointed out, Fred, and I'll just say it even more starkly, most plans today are really bad distribution vehicles. They're not set up for that. They're set up to be institutional accumulation vehicles, and the rollover is actually a critical component. Rollover to an IRA is a critical component of most participants', you know, sort of lifetime savings plan, because they finally get to sit down with someone who says, okay, you've been hopefully doing a good job of piling up some money. Now let's talk about how we're going to actually get that to last you into your 80s or, you know, whatever your particular needs are. And this whole process, I think, is going to make that much more difficult unless DOL makes some significant changes between the proposal and the final rule. Broker-dealers, I think, are one of the groups that are going to be most impacted because DOL, at least to date, is not really drawing a distinction between sales and advice. And that's a distinction that we, as Fred said, have had historically throughout financial services. And DOL is really trying to run counter to that trend, particularly in the IRA space. And that's just going to be a very difficult transition for a lot of folks to make. So when DOL says, for example, well, we're not eliminating commissions, you know, it's true. Nothing in this proposal says there shall be no commissions. I think I butchered my, you know, 16th century English conjugation of to be. But leaving that aside, what they are saying, though, is you have to receive level compensation. So whether it comes from a commission or a 12B1 fee, they are sort of agnostic as to that. but it may be so administratively difficult to levelize commissions that it's tantamount to a prohibition. So there are a lot of those kinds of issues we're going to have to sort through. And I think the rollover situation is a big one. In the IRA space in general, I have a host of concerns about how DOL has proposed this. And I think it has to change for them even to achieve their own objectives from what's in this proposal and change substantially.
Okay, operator. Brad got the last word, and just to add a last word to the last word, I agree with everything he said. So, operator, let's go to Q&As.
At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off to ensure your signal can reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open, and state your name before posing your question. Again, it's star 1. And we'll go first. Caller, your line is open.
My name is Arthur Harris, and I have a question about the comment made by one of the gentlemen in the beginning that the BICE exemption is not available to plans. There seems to me to be a very, very narrow exception in the definition of retirement investor that says it is open to plans if you're dealing with a plan sponsor of a non-participant-directed ERISA plan that has fewer than 100 participants. Strikes me as a very odd little definition. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Brad, do you want to handle it?
Yeah, no, I did say that, and you're technically correct, absolutely. I've been not even, frankly, bothering to flag that particular limited exception in conversations like this because, as you say, it's so unique and small that it's been easier and accurate for most folks just to say, well, you know, it doesn't apply to plans. It's really about participants and IRA owners. You are correct. I mean, looking at that, we've concluded that this is basically very small profit-sharing plans, potentially. I'm not sure it matters a whole lot either way, although I guess it might in certain unique circumstances. But frankly, you know, given the hierarchy of issues, that's been one that's been low enough that we've been able to kind of be a little more general about it. So you're correct that that is technically the way the proposed rule reads.
Thank you.
And again, it's star 1 to ask a question. I'll pause for a moment to give everyone a chance to signal. And we'll take our next caller. Your line is open.
Hello, this is Alice Palmer.
Yes, hi. How are you, Alice?
I have a question about essentially what your thoughts are on how an advisor would market their own proprietary products under the proposed rule without engaging in a prohibited transaction if they, benefit from the fact that if the investor selects their proprietary advisory service, then that advisor would earn a fee for the provision of that advice.
Yeah, Brad, check me on this, but two thoughts come to mind, Alice, and Brad may have others. But one, I think from a provider perspective, you know, if it's like a group annuity contract or a provider platform, that they can still say, hey, here's our platform available for people to purchase. And in other words, they can say, here's a commercial offering, but without making any recommendations of any funds over another. Also on the provider platform, there is a platform carve out in the fiduciary rule that says that a provider could have a platform of funds and that they could provide tools to advisors and plan sponsors. For example, tools that would consider the factors that are important to plan sponsors, low expense ratios, low volatility, above average performance, whatever.
So
they could let plan sponsors select criteria and then they could apply them.
How would a managed account solution provider market a managed account solution to a small plan, a small participant-directed plan?
Yeah, that's going to be
very
difficult because if assuming that the managed account provider that the managed account firm is owned by the provider, such that in effect a member of the provider's family has discretion, that's outside of BICE because it involves discretion.
And it, mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about the small plan, the small 401k participant-directed plan. So BICE is not available for that. I don't think the platform provider carve-out works because it's not a suite of investments necessarily. It's a managed account service.
Exactly. Exactly.
So do you see anything that could work?
Wow.
Education, per se?
Yeah, just to jump in, as it's currently proposed, I think what you've identified is a problem probably for a number of different types of providers of services within plans, as well as in IRAs, where you're saying, look, I provide a service that's elective to participants in this plan. When I let them know about this service, am I just informing them of their options under the plan, which has typically traditionally been education, or am I actually recommending myself to provide this fiduciary service? And if so, is that a fiduciary bit of advice? Is that a prohibited transaction? I think DOL's created some created some ambiguity in this space. I would suggest that DOL ought to treat some of these issues differently. If, for example, the plan has hired you to provide advice, and that includes the availability of a managed account service, so you're functioning as a DIM to that plan, DOL ought to allow you to discuss that with the plan participants without that being fiduciary advice. If their concern is participants need to be protected, from predatory behavior or whatever it is they're concerned about, here, the plan has decided to hire you to do that. So that really ought to stand in the shoes of that protection, and there shouldn't be any additional hassle and paperwork involved in letting participants know that this is an option that's available to them where someone else will make all the financial decisions for them. And there already are disclosures about fees and all the other things within the plan that they need to make. So I would think this is an area DOL could offer some clarity that would reduce some of these concerns.
But it's not
in there yet.
I think, Allison, there's that issue that Brad is mentioning, and related to that, since the DIM would have its own products in the plan, you'd have discretionary management where they could select their own products. That's outside of BICE. Brad, was it 77-4 or 77-5 that has an exemption for using proprietary products?
I think it's 4, but don't hold me to that.
But,
I tend to look at things that occurred in 1977.
I can't remember exactly, but you might take a look at prohibited transaction class exemptions, 77-4 or 77-5. Right in that range, there were some about, I don't know if they're really workable. I leave that to you, but there were some exemptions about where a fiduciary could select its own proprietary products and how there could be an exemption with certain conditions in that case. I just don't remember enough about it, but that's the only thing I can think of.
Okay, thank you.
77-4 would apply to investment companies, open-ended mutual funds.
Really?
That wouldn't be
as helpful then for a managed account.
I think you put your finger on an issue that how about this? Let's encourage you to write a comment on that to DOL.
Yeah,
presumably they want to encourage DIMs and other solutions for participants that solve all the problems of not rebalancing, of not making good investment decisions, of not having all the information necessary to know what they're doing. DIMs are an approach DOL ought to be embracing. So certainly there shouldn't be any additional barriers erected here that aren't intentional. And it may well be that it's not intentional. I mean, this is the scope of this change is so massive that there are unintended consequences everywhere. And we just haven't really heard DOL explaining which ones were intended and which ones are unintended. And the comment period is going to help us sort that out.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Hi. Okay. Operator, we can handle one more question if there is one more.
And our next question, caller, your line is open.
Hi, my name is Terry Brunsman, and I think I may have misunderstood one of the comments made earlier when we were talking about independent RIAs.
Uh-huh.
I think the one comment was that advice to IRAs was you weren't under the rule. You weren't an ERISA fiduciary because of level compensation. But when I read the rule, it seems like you fit into those columns of, making a recommendation or giving advice and getting compensated. So it seems like you are under the rule. Are you saying you don't have to worry about being an ERISA fiduciary because of the – isn't the level compensation concept in ERISA?
Well,
so I'm confused
by
that.
This is a fine legal distinction, but okay. It's a good question. There's two – this rule is going to be two places, verbatim, in two places. It's going to be a regulation under the Internal Revenue Code and a regulation under ERISA. The ERISA regulation can only govern ERISA plans, period. Since an IRA isn't an ERISA plan, unless it's a simple or a sub-IRA, you're simply not covered jurisdictionally by the Department of Labor or the rule under ERISA. But you would be a fiduciary under the Internal Revenue Code. The difference between the two is the definition of fiduciary under the Internal Revenue Code is only for prohibited transaction purposes. It is not a standard of care. So your standard of care would continue to be the standard of care under the federal securities laws and state securities laws. So the point I was trying to make was that there is not an ERISA fiduciary standard of care for advice to IRAs by level fee advisors. But then you might say, well, shoot, if that's the case, how can we say that broker-dealers are going to be subject to the ERISA prudent man rule or the best interest rule? The way the Department of Labor did that is they said, okay, the advice would be fiduciary advice, which would cause you to commit a prohibited transaction to an IRA, which would cause you to commit a prohibited transaction under the Internal Revenue Code. But we will give you an exemption if you agree to be a fiduciary. That's where Brad was saying it creates all these contract claims and potentially contract class actions. That was how the Department of Labor did it. Strategically, very, very clever. I mean, you got to take your hat off to them on that issue. It was an ingenious, some would say diabolical, way of bringing IRAs.
Yeah, I like the little genius.
Of bringing IRAs effectively under the jurisdiction of the Department of Labor. It doesn't really, but it has that feeling to it because it forces them into a contract that they can be sued on. Does that explain it? It's really tough.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. That's very helpful.
Okay, well, everybody, thank you. Jim, I think it's back to you.
Thanks, Fred, and thanks, Brad, for the call today. Your comments have certainly been insightful and helpful, and I know that everyone appreciates the information. We appreciate that we're able to do these calls quarterly. On behalf of Natixis, I just want to thank everyone for calling in today and spending time with us. And please mark your calendars for September 10th. That will be our third call of the year. And, Christy, I'll turn it back to you, and you can close out the call.
That concludes our call for today. Thank you for your participation.